Take 5. City Talk 105.9.
City Talk 105.9. This is the home of great music and great conversation. It has just gone 2 o'clock on this slightly gloomy Tuesday, and hopefully I can cheer you up over the next hour, because as always around this time, I am joined by a studio guest who is going to talk us through the five records they would save from their home if it was on fire. Which five singles would you pick? It is a tough question. We never said it was going to be easy. Plus, which book, which film, which object and which photograph would they pluck from the flames as well? And I'm very pleased to say that my guest today, I think he's a big hitter. I think it's fair to say that David Morrissey, you are a big hitter.
A big hitter?
Yeah, have you been told that before?
No, not recently.
No, it's, you're a big hitter because you're an actor and a very successful actor and a director.
Thanks, as well.
So I'm pleased to have you in the studio. Although I must say, I'm going to start off with a little bit of... I'm going to pick a fight with you to start off with.
Right.
We've met before. Yeah. It was about a year ago, I think. When I was covering the Dean Sullivan show.
Very well.
Thank you very much. Yeah. You came up for an interview and it was quite exciting. And everyone said afterwards, how was David Morrissey? And I said, yeah, he was quite good, actually. I think I got a lot out of him. I think, you know, I found out, I probed him. You know, I think I got more out of him than the average interviewer.
Yeah.
That very night, you went off and did a Q&A.
And told everybody the same I told you.
And told everyone that you're in Doctor Who.
Well, you hadn't probed me on that one. You see, obviously your research had sort of lacked on that one.
That was a great surprise, though, because you played... kind of, well, the episode was called The Next Doctor.
It was really odd because it was called The Next Doctor. We did it in February, although it was the Christmas special.
Yeah.
And at the time when I was filming it, I didn't know that David Tennant was going to be leaving.
Yeah.
And then Russell and T. Davis got in touch with me and said, listen, you know, David's going to leave and the episode's called The Next Doctor. It's the Christmas special. So we're going to sort of do this tantalizing thing of like, it could be you. You could be taking over at Christmas. Are you cool with that? And I said, yeah, sure. He said, the thing is, you just can't tell anyone that it's not you. And I said, okay. I can tell my kids, though. And he went, no.
Definitely not
just
them.
No. He said, they'll tell someone in the playground, they'll tell their mates, and then suddenly everybody knows, you know. So I couldn't even tell my children. So it started coming out in the press that I was possibly the next Doctor Who. My kids were saying, Dad, are you? And I was like, I'm not allowed to tell you. And I got to the point where I
could tell you, but I have to kill you.
Yeah, it was that thing of like, if you go to bed now, I might tell you later. Do you know what I mean? And so if you do your homework, I might get you today. But it was a real weird one. And sort of, it was the first time in my life as an actor where people were sort of jumping out of bushes and taking pictures of me and stuff. Yeah. So that was quite weird.
Well, you revealed it that very night, I think it was, at a Q&A session you were doing. And I read it on the front page of The Echo the next day. Felt slightly sick. But because you've come in and done Take 5 with me, I'm going to forgive you. You'll be glad to know. You have a full absolution. But you're doing a Q&A session tonight, which again makes me feel nervous. What are you going to announce tonight? That you're running for PM? Or
No, that's a later press conference, obviously. But no, I'm actually doing a screening of a film I shot here in Liverpool a couple of years ago called Don't Worry About Me, which comes out on the BBC in February.
Mm.
And then is out on DVD after that, and hopefully is having some special screenings around the country before then. And it's in aid of Clapperboard, which is a charity I support, which is a wonderful charity, which gets kids into doing films and making their own stories and giving them a voice really through the medium of film, which is something that I found very useful in my life. And you know, and I think Clapperboard are great at doing that. But it's to do with the screening of my film, and then afterwards myself and the cast and the producer are doing a Q&A for the audience. So that'll be more about, it won't be any big revealing things about my career, it'll be more about how did you make the film, I think.
Okay, we'll see, but I will approach tomorrow's Liverpool Echo with trepidation. I think that's at the fact, isn't it?
It's a fact tonight, yeah.
Do we know if any tickets are still available?
I think there are tickets available, yeah, you know, a few anyway, I think.
Okay, if you want to watch directorial piece by David Morrissey. I was going to say it was your debut, but it's not, is it?
It's my feature film debut. Right. I've done a couple of TVs before, and I've done a couple of tellies before as a director, so it's not my... it's not my real debut, but this is my feature film debut. And it's also a film that's made purely by my own company, so it was completely financed by myself.
Fantastic.
Well, getting finance from people in the business community rather than the film community. So, yeah, it's a debut in that way.
And it's called Don't Worry About Me. So if you want to see that at FACT tonight, and then you get to ask David impertinent questions afterwards about the making of it, then it sounds like a good do. And Clapperboard, as you say, is great. We're to use an awful showbiz expression, Clapperboard's like a friend of the show, because Maureen Sinclair is a good contact of mine.
She's wonderful, Maureen.
She is. She does a lot of work. Do you think, and you did say that Clapperboard, it helps kids who might be at the fringes of society sort of find a voice and a bit of sense of purpose in life by working in film. You found the Everyman Youth Theatre at a fairly young age. Was there ever a chance that young David Morrissey was going off the rails, or were you always a good boy?
No, I don't think I was a good boy, but I don't think, you know, I was necessarily bad either. It's a difficult age, that. I mean, I lost my dad when I was sort of 15, really. So, you know, I could have gone either way. But I was very... You know, came from a very stable background, and my brothers and sister and my mum, you know, it was a very tight unit, my family. So I had all that going for me. But then, you know, we know that that's no guarantee for not going off the rails as well. So, but acting certainly gave me a purpose. It gave me a sense of self. It gave me some, like a confidence in myself, which I hadn't already had. I knew that I could stand up and perform. It gave me a community as well. It gave me appreciation for other things besides, you know, my self-obsession, really, you know. So that was good. And but it also, it taught me about work. It really did. It's where I learnt about hard work. It's where I learnt about, you know, that you, what you get out of something is equal to what you put into it, and all those things, really. And the Everyman was a very vibrant time. It's where my closest friendships in life have come from, really.
Is that with the, because I know there was some other sort of household name actor, Stephen Hart was around.
Ian Hart, and the McGanns and stuff like that. But I mean, Ian is my best friend, and you know, I've been knowing him since I was a kid, really. But our friendship really got forged doing shows and performing at the Everyman, and also, you know, at that time it was run by Roger Hill, who was a great influence on my life, really.
It was one summer you did with Ian, wasn't it? The story of two sort of...
It was Ian and I and a guy called Spencer Lee, who I saw recently actually in New York. He lives in New York now, lives in Brooklyn. But it was a Willie Russell piece. It was about a Channel 4 drama. It was one of the first, I think, drama series that Channel 4 did. And it was about two Scouse lads who ran away to Wales. And, you know, they were sort of from a deprived background, and one of them just has had enough, really, and he wants to get off. So he goes to the one place that he remembers having a happy time, an idyllic time, and that was on a school camping trip to Wales. But of course, when he gets there, there's none of the organisation that he experienced when he was on the school trip. And there's these two boys in the wilderness, really, and they get befriended by this guy who's an artist, and he takes them in, and he's an ex-teacher. And then there's all the complications of people coming back to get him, to get the boys and stuff like that. And I want to stay, and Icky, who's Spencer Lee, doesn't want, he wants to go back home. And that's tension between the two of us.
I read somewhere that Willie Russell was upset at the casting of you because he thought you were too old. I think you were 18 when you were cast, and you were meant to be 15 or 16. Has that been overstated?
Yeah, that's not true. In my experience, that's not true. I was actually 16. Mm. I think I was the right age. I think he had difficulty with some of the casting. I don't know whether it was mine. Mm. But I think he had what's commonly known as creative differences with the director, who, again, was a man I really loved, a guy called Gordon Fleming. Mm. And I decided even then to sort of step back out of that sort of politics, really. You know, I'd been cast, I was playing the lead. I didn't want anything else to play with my head, really.
Yeah, why should you? 16-year-old boy, it wasn't your place to get involved.
Yeah, and I just got on to playing the role. And I met Willie afterwards. After I did the job, I went and worked in the Everyman Bistro. I worked downstairs, and Willie had an office then. I remember talking to him, and he assured me then it was nothing to do with me. And I think Willie's quite a generous man. He's a really... You know, we all know him as a wonderful writer. And I think it was just about creative differences between him and the production, really, in the end. And he took his name off it, which I was very sad about. But they sold it as, typically, you know, they sold it as from the writer of Educating Rita. So everybody knew that it was Willie, you know. But and I think I loved the writing of the piece. I just thought it was wonderful. And I felt that we had been as true to it as we could have. It would have been a great thing for me to have him on board.
But now you've directed yourself and been an actor as well. Have you experienced perhaps some of those politics yourself now that you were not able to step away from?
Yeah, the more, you know, the more role you take on, particularly as a director and a producer, then you're going to get involved in those battles, really. Mm. But usually they can be sorted out in a creative, you know, in a good way creatively. They don't have to be filled with animosity and sort of conflict. And I think when you get artistic people around a table and they're discussing, they everyone has strong opinions. You know, that's why you're there. You're there to have your opinions and to give them. And it's about, you know, at one point, everyone stepping back and saying, what's best for the job, you know, rather than what's best for you or me or whatever, what's best for the overall thing. Well, I like all that. I think that, you know, cut and thrust of sitting down and debating scripts and characters and casting and all that, you know, there was a point, you know, about 15 years ago, and it was really getting to me and I hated it all. And then I suddenly realised that actually that was my job. That was my job. As much as walking on set and being a character, it was my job to defend my place, to sort of, you know, have opinions, to get involved in creative discussions. Other people might call them rows, but I would call them creative discussions.
Well, I was going to say, are you a coffee cup thrower, a door slammer, a stomper outer? Do you tend to get quite emotionally involved in these discussions and express yourself almost physically, or do you keep a lid on it? Because you're coming across very cool now, but I wonder if you have a darker side.
Yeah, I really find my corner. I definitely do. And I also, I don't think I throw things or anything like that, but I, you know, I can raise my voice and I can shout and I can argue it. But what you're trying to do is, I always think what's really important in a situation like that is that the person in front of you who maybe have a conflicting opinion to you is that they see that you're listening to what they're saying, that you're taking on board before you ignore it. Yeah, so it's that thing of making sure they know that you're listening to them before you decide to give them your opinion. But I do, you know, it has to be like that. There has to be, if you're the director or the producer of a film, there is a point where you want it to be a democratic process, but actually in the end it's not. It's a dictatorship, and someone has to make the decision. When you're sitting, you know, when you're on a film set and that, you know, it's supposed to be a sunny day and it's raining and the light's going, someone has to make a decision. You can't sit there going, what should we do now? Someone has to take hold of the reins and say, right, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And that is the process all the time, really, is people will be looking to someone, or maybe, you know, in something like the Coen brothers, it's probably two people. But you can't have this democratic decision by committee at those times. They just that doesn't work for me. Someone has to take control.
You're a benign dictator.
I wouldn't. I think I'm just a dictator, really.
Well, you've dictated five tunes to me that we're going to play over the next hour. They are the five records you would rescue from your burning home. And the first one is from a band. Well, we had Eddie Emu on this show, actually, a few weeks ago. It's The Real Thing. Which one have you gone for?
Yeah, I've gone for You to Me or Everything. They're a big band for me, actually, because, you know, just growing up and stuff. And I remember seeing them on the TV first before I knew where they were from, and my brother telling me they were from Liverpool. And I thought they were this like Detroit Motown guys.
Well, that's exactly what they
were. And that's where they came from. You know, that was, you know, that's where their music came from and what they listened to. And just seeing how tight they were as a unit was just unbelievable. And I was so proud that they were from my city as well.
Yeah. Eddie said something amazing when he was on this show. He said that he was invited to play at the Cavern by Paul McCartney, actually. Right. Sort of said he'd get them in, and he'd never heard of the Cavern. I said, well, he says, in those days, if you were from Toxteth, you stayed in Toxteth.
Well, that was the great thing about being from Liverpool, from into the Everyman as well, was that you were right on that periphery of Toxteth and stuff. So, but it was it's a great record, and I love it. Yeah.
A fine choice to start off the show with. It is You to Me, Everything, by Eddie Emu, and of course The Real Thing from right here in Liverpool. It's the first choice of David Morrissey, who is my guest on today's Take 5. The first choice of my guest on today's Take 5, who is the actor and indeed director David Morrissey, Liverpool born and bred and raised, and a fine actor of stage and screen, both large and small. Do you come back and stay with your family when you're here, David, or do you stay in a hotel and have security to keep them away?
I stay with my brother sometimes, or mostly with my brother is where I stay when I come up, and I come up quite regularly now. Yeah.
And you were kind of from the Kensington, and then is it Notting you moved to?
Yeah, I was born in Kensington, and then they knocked that down, and then we moved to Notting to an estate up there, and I lived there, and I went to school in Duffcott, and then all my family now live over in Crosby. Yeah.
And have they got sort of creative jobs as well, or do they often get proper jobs?
Well, they're teachers, but one of my brothers and my sister are both teachers. Mm-hmm. And then my eldest brother sort of runs his own telecommunications company, but he's also involved in my company, which is Tubedale Films, which is based here in Liverpool, and well, that was the company I made my film through. So we set up a film company together about 6 years ago now. So, and you know, he's the business side of it. That always makes me fall asleep, all the business side. I just can't do it.
You need someone to take care of that, don't you?
So somebody else has to do all that. And then it's always that sense, you know, there's somebody getting in there and doing all the lawyers and the contracts and stuff like that. That's not my area of expertise at all, really. So he's able to do all that, and I do the meeting with writers and trying to get scripts off the ground and stuff, all the creative side, really.
And one script that did get off the ground was Don't Worry About Me. You're having a screening of that tonight in aid of Clapperboard UK at FACT, and you'll be doing a Q&A after that, hence the fact that you're in Liverpool.
Yeah, yeah, and it's great being back. I mean, it's sort of interesting because today I was just doing another thing where I was walking around some of the locations we used for the film, you know, and the film started out as a play. It was called The Pool, and I saw it in London, written by a Liverpool girl and a Cockney lad, and I really like the story. The play is very different from the film, but I like the basic story.
It's a Londoner stuck in Liverpool almost, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about a guy who has a one-night stand with a Liverpool girl in London, and he thinks this is the love of his life, so he comes up here to find her, and when he finds her, she's not as single as she'd led him to believe, and he's sort of on his own in the city, and then he meets this other girl just by accident in a bookies, and he sort of spends the day with her, really, and it's about how these two very... You know, they're not a very compatible couple at all, you know. In fact, they're sort of the complete opposites, really. But it's about how they sort of get to know each other and share their secrets with each other.
Is it ultimately uplifting, or does it have a denouement?
It's sort of, in the end, I think it's about, you know, the girl certainly is able to move on in her life, yeah. So it has an uplifting ending in the sense that somebody is freed from a burden that they're carrying, yeah, definitely. And I would like people to come out feeling that the title referred to this girl that, you know, we did have concerns about her and worries about her, and actually we don't have to anymore, that she's going to be all right.
But one film that certainly does have a denouement, is pretty bleak a watch in my experience, is Kez, which is the film that you have chosen to rescue from the metaphorical house fire we've put you in.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big influence on me, Kez. I mean, as most of Ken Loach's work is, really. But I, you know, for me, I watched telly all the time when I was a kid. That was my big friend, really, was TV, really, sadly enough. But, you know, and I watched all sorts of things, and I watched TV drama, and I watched big Hollywood musicals and films and stuff like that. Everything I could, was allowed to watch, I watched. And I remember seeing Kez on TV, and it was a very different emotional experience for me watching this film. It was like, suddenly, although my life didn't reflect Billy Casper's life at all, but it did, the school he went to was very like my school. I knew people like him. I knew, you know, even great hilarious moments like the football match. There was things in it, there was observational things in it that were just like our school football days, you know.
Which was De La Salle, wasn't it?
No, I went to St. Margaret Mary's, and then I went to De La Salle for like one term. To reset my O-levels. But no, my schooling really was St. Margaret Mary's Secondary Modern in Duffcott. Kez, the sort of atmosphere of the school was very much like Kez, really. And it was the first time I'd seen, you know, there was no pandering, like the dialects were very, very strong. The sort of, I couldn't see the join between acting and being. There was a sense that these boys and the careers officer and the head teacher and stuff, they didn't seem to be acting. They didn't seem to have what other actors had. And the things I've been watching, like Coronation Street or the big films I've been watching, they always seem to be performing, and they seem to be like, there was really a piece of glass between me and them. It was a different world. Whereas in Kez, I knew it wasn't a documentary. I knew it was a story, but I couldn't see the join of it. And I knew that it had music in it. And I knew that it was emotional, and but it troubled me in a way and upset me in a way that nothing else had touched me in that way before. It was sort of, I really did worry about Billy. I worried about what would happen to him when he came in having found the bird, and he attacks Judd, and Judd's just pushing him aside. The injustice of it just really sort of got me. And I looked at the world differently from then on. I really looked at the creative world differently. I looked at filmmakers differently. And I think what it's left with me is a love and a desire that where I like acting where I can't see the join. I like films where I slightly can't see the join, where it's like I'm peeping into a world rather than sort of being taken out of my own.
And I think perhaps the most obvious example and the most high-profile example of that type of work was your portrayal of Gordon Brown in The Deal.
Yeah, I don't know whether I would equate that with that. I think the thing about Brown, the deal was very much to do with... that was a new type of television, I felt, where, you know, Michael and I were doing characters that were very recognisable, political characters that people lived with all the time. And we were very nervous about how that would come across, whether we were seen as just an extended Rory Bremner sketch or whether it was, you know, we fall flat on our faces or whatever. And I thought that was very well handled by Stephen Frears. I wouldn't equate it with the Loach stuff, although it's very interesting that Loach and Stephen Frears come from a very similar school. They come from that BBC heyday of Play for Today sort of stuff. But and I should imagine that their influences are the same in people like Carol Rice and Lindsay Anderson, but and that's free cinema. But no, I would think there was very much my... the deal was very much about recognisable characters and actors playing those characters.
We've seen Gordon Brown getting hauled over the coals recently. The poor guy can't catch a break, and some would say, well, he deserves it, and some wouldn't. But I noticed yesterday he was being criticised for his handwriting in a letter to the mother of a soldier who died abroad. And I thought, my God, the guy can't do anything right when he's writing handwritten notes to people and getting scolded for his handwriting. You know things are up against you. Do you feel a certain protection towards him because you've played him as a character, or can you detach yourself from that?
I certainly wouldn't protect him over that letter. I thought that was quite odd, that letter, and I did think that it was more indicative of Downing Street than him, really. I feel that, you know, there should be somebody checking those things and stuff, you know, but in one on the other hand, it is, you know, a handwritten letter is an amazing thing, obviously, to get, but it's, you know, you have to be doing those well, and you have to have real sentiment behind them. And I did feel that was really sort of crashed, really, in the end. But, I do feel I have insight. You know, I do feel very much, I look at him and feel for him in a big way, really, because I, you know, having played him and read a lot about him, I feel I do have an understanding and a sympathy for him. And I do think at heart he is a really good man, and I think he has great socialist principles. I think he's somebody who, you know, he's sort of leading a government that is under great pressure at the moment. But I think where he's coming from and where his heart lies is a really great, caring place. And I think his desire, you know, certainly to eradicate poverty and stuff and sort of give us a level playing field are really genuine, really. But... and also, I don't feel that the opposition are offering us that. So, you know, I would very much be on his side. But, there are things about it at the moment which one finds hard to defend or even understand.
But, yeah, it's funny, actually, because the deal was back in 2003, wasn't it? And almost an equivalent, although I don't think it was particularly good, was on recently when Boris met Dave, which was...
Oh, I didn't see that.
It was a dramatic sort of reconstruction of David Cameron and Boris Johnson's days together at the Bullingdon Club in Oxford in 1987. Again, it was someone sort of taking something that really did happen, as we know the deal happened at the Granita restaurant between Tony and Gordon, and kind of imagining the rest and building up around it. Having said that, I don't think it was very good.
So, I haven't seen it.
So I tell you what, we'll push on. And instead, we'll play something that we know is good, which is your second track, Echo and the Bunnymen. Which one have you gone for?
I've gone for The Killing Moon, which is it's a big track. They're a great band for me. And it's very much about growing up in Liverpool at that time. And they were, you know, seeing them perform. And just, I just love this particular track. But there was a lot I could have chosen, to be honest.
Absolutely. Well, you've gone for this one. It is Echo and the Bunnymen, The Killing Moon on City Talk 105.9. The second choice of today's guest, who is the actor and director, David Morrissey. City Talk 105.9, that's Echo and the Bunnymen, The Killing Moon, the second choice of David Morrissey, my guest on today's Take 5. The time has just gone 2:30, and if you can do the maths, we've got 3 songs to get out and some more stuff as well. I'm running over on time, so without further ado, I'm just going to say this, back in a couple of minutes.
This is Take 5, City Talk 105.9.
Yes, indeed, Take 5 with me, Will Batchelor, from now until 3 o'clock today. I am in company of David Morrissey, the actor and director, who is in town. If you want to go and see David, he's doing a Q&A tonight at the Fact Cinema following a screening of his directorial film, Don't Worry About Me, and that is in aid of Clapperboard UK, which is a great charity. Stick it into Google, have a look at what they do. And I know that Clapperboard are always kind of in the market for people to perhaps sponsor these events that they do. Every a month or 6 weeks or so when they get one of the great and the good of the film and television world, like David, to show us a film and then talk afterwards. It's a great thing they're doing and very exciting for the city as well. David, you have to be frog marched at the tower to imagine that you're in a house fire, as you know, and you get to rescue five records. We've had two of them already, got three to come, plus a few other bits and pieces, including a photograph. Which one have you gone for?
It's quite easy for me because it's right on the wall as I walk out of my house, really. It's a photograph of my son, my eldest son, when he was about 8 or 9, I think. And he's being painted by my father-in-law, Lucien Freud. And you can just see my wife's legs. She's sitting on the floor, and you can just see that at the bottom. And it's really, it's sort of a great example of sort of, you know, my son's sitting there sort of slightly bored, with this slightly bored expression, but Lucien sort of just having this intensity of looking at him. And you can also see the painting emerging on the easel as he's painting it. So it encapsulates so much of, you know...
That's not bad, having Lucien Freud as a father-in-law to be able to do that. It means you don't have to take him down to Lewis's and get one of those pictures taken there.
Right, yeah, so he could have it just up on the wall. But no, I think it was, and it's also, I think, for any grandson to spend time with their grandfather is important, and it was nice for them to just have this time together, really, and they got on very well. And I think it's also great. It was great for my wife to be able to sort of be there with her son and her father. And those times, really, without any sort of distractions or TV or anything like that, it was just great for them just to be in the room for a couple of hours every week.
You know? And you've got three kids.
I have. I've got a 14-year-old boy, an 11-year-old girl, and a 5-year-old boy.
Yeah. Is your boy, perhaps the other two are a bit young, but your 14-year-old, that's Albie, is it?
Yeah.
Is he expressing any interest in the acting or film, TV career?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, I mean... Doctors' kids become doctors, lawyers' kids become lawyers. You know, is that saying, you know, he sees my profession and sort of has lots of questions about it, and I'm able to tell him about it. But no, at the moment he's sort of, you know, he's just gone into, I don't know what year it is, but it's like he's doing his choices now, so he's ratcheted up, he's more homework. So I think he's just sort of getting his head down for that. Right?
We were talking off air about feeling old, particularly when you go out and see people. You definitely know you're old. It's like, you know you're old when policemen are getting younger, and you also know you're old when you don't understand what year kids are in school anymore. So what year are you in? I'm in year 10. It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything to me anymore. So that's very true. So I don't know. I just know that he's done his choices, and he's got more homework than he used to have. You know?
Excellent. Well, that'll keep him quiet. And that is the photograph you're going to save. It is a photograph of a portrait in the work of being done by Lucien Freud of your boy. That's safe. As is your next song, which is it kind of almost relates to that photograph, doesn't it? Kate Bush.
Yeah, a man with the child in his eyes. I think I really like this song. I'm a big Kate Bush fan, and I mean, when I was a kid, very much so. I mean, I was slightly in love with her, really.
Yeah.
But a lot of men were. But also, she wrote this song when she was 15, I think. And, you know, it's
really?
Yeah, you know, sort of on the back of a sort of school exercise book or something. And I just think that sentiment is wonderful, and her voice is just insurpassable for me. I just love it. And so, yeah, here it is.
That's amazing. That's Paul McCartney levels of precociousness.
Yeah.
But in a good way.
Yeah.
In a good way. It is Kate Bush, the man with a child in his eyes. City Talk 105.9. It's Kate Bush, the man with a child in his eyes, written, according to my guest, David Morrissey, when she was about 15, when I was slumped, glassy-eyed in front of gladiators. It makes you feel slightly untalented. Well, not you, David, because you were probably doing great things when you were 15 as well at the Everyman.
Yeah, we did. I wasn't writing songs like that, though. I think I was just running around with a stick-on beard or something, pretending to be old men or something. But it was a very 15. That time for me was very vibrant. It was great. There was lots of great stuff going on, and great. The city was great at that time as well. I'm sure it is now, but there was so much going on, particularly musically.
Do you feel the city is as creative as it used to be? I mean, I guess 15. You're talking about the early 80s, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I mean, you know, when I came up here to make Don't Worry About Me, I was looking for local talent. I was looking for people who could work with me, and I found lots of people. Yeah, so it does seem vibrant to me. It's certainly musically. You know, there was lots of stuff I was being sent that I thought was great. There's a girl on my film called Rachel Wright, who's a singer-songwriter from up here, who's just brilliant. You know, I was amazed she didn't have any sort of deal in place, really. So, yeah, I think it is. It's, you know, it's always being creative. It's just about places where people can express that creativity. You know, it's about whether the clubs are there to play the bands, and whether sort of the industry is supportive of people writing and sort of making films and stuff like that.
Talking of films made in Liverpool, Nowhere Boy is the latest one to sort of try and track the life of the early life of the Beatles, John and Paul in particular. And I know that you you play a part in that, don't you?
Yeah, I played Bobby Dykens, who was married to John's mum. Julia had two daughters with her. And John comes back into their life, comes back into his mother's life when he's about 14, 15. And, you know, he's not particularly welcomed with open arms by Bobby Dykens, because there's a sense that, you know, here he is in this stable family with his wife and two daughters, and this very sort of, as we know, very sort of creative, cheeky, sort of quite complex young man comes into his life. So, you know, he's a little bit sort of aggressive towards John and doesn't want him in the life. In his life, but yeah, it was made here. It was made. It was shot in all the exteriors were shot in Liverpool, and it's just the period between when John discovers his mother again, Julia, who's left him when he was a young boy. Mm. He was brought up by his aunt Mimi, and it's about those two sisters and the conflict over this boy. Really, it's much more about Lennon than it is about McCartney. Although McCartney's in it, and that's a wonderful sort of part of the story, is when they meet in that sort of village face,
yeah,
you know,
St. Peter's,
and that's really interesting and sort of great, really. But it's, for me, the film is about these two women fighting over the love of this boy. You know?
I get frightened when I think about that meeting at St. Peter's, because I just think so much hinged on that meeting. What if one of them had a cold or hadn't turned up or something? It's, you like to think maybe they'd have met a bit later down the line or something, but can you imagine how different the world would be if that fate had been rained off?
But there were so many stars lined up for that meeting to happen. It felt to me that it would have happened anyway. You know, John's circle of friends that sort of overlap with John, with Paul's circles of friends, they sort of would have put those guys who actually became the Quarrymen, in a way, they sort of knew that they had one talent, and then they met this other one, and they brought them all together. And then, of course, Paul already knew George. So, yeah, I think the stars were lined up for them to meet anyway. Really.
It was meant to be. Nowhere Boy, there's a special screening. I know you're a patron of the Alder Hey.
Imagine Charity for Alder Hey. There's a special screening on the 23rd of November here in this Liverpool L1 Odeon. So, and that's to support Imagine, which is, I heard as I walked into the studio, is also being donated some of this amazing lottery money.
That's the Magnificent Seven, one of them, I think her boy was treated for a hole in the heart at Alder Hey, and she has said that she's going to give some cash of her 5.5 million.
Wonderful to hear, because it's a great cause, and I would urge people to sort of support that as well.
Great news. That is on the 23rd of November. I'm fairly sure that if you go onto the Imagine website via the Alder Hey website, then you'll find out the details of how you can go and see that special screening and watch Nowhere Boy, and also help out Alder Hey Hospital as well. Very quickly, David, because we're running out of time, and I know we're both very keen to play your fourth record, which is Slade, and I promise it's coming up. Your favourite book, Great Expectations by Charles Dickens.
Yes, in three seconds.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
In 3 seconds, Great Expectations. It is, actually. It's my favourite book, and it's the book that I return to all the time and read all the time, and I find new, like with all Dickens, actually, I find new things in all the time. I came late to reading literature, and you know, the thing about Dickens is you look at them and they're big old books and you feel that they're really intimidating, but it's only the page count that's intimidating. Yeah. The writing is never intimidating. And actually, whenever I read it, I suddenly just feel I'm lost in that world, and Great Expectations particularly, because it's such a great mystery.
Right? But you could have chosen Our Mutual Friend, which is one of your TV productions that was a remake of the Dickens book.
Yeah, we did. We did an adaptation of that, and I played Bradley Headstone, or Bradley Headcase, as I called him. And Paul McGann was in that as well. I've done a few jobs with Paul. But it was a really, that is a fantastic book as well. But because Expectations was my first Dickens novel that I read, that's the one that I always come back to.
Well, listen, I'm not going to argue with you, A, because it's your choice, and B, because we need to play an ad break so we can play Slade. So let's do it now. Back in a minute.
This is Take 5, City Talk 105.9.
City Talk 105.9 is the station, the home of great music and great conversation. Both of those things coming this hour, courtesy of David Morrissey, the Liverpool-born actor, star of the stage and the small screen, and indeed the big screen as well. Got two more records to come. I'm glad you've chosen short ones, David.
Thank you very much for that. I did that thinking because that we'd be chattering away.
We have been chatting away, but it's been good. It's been illuminating. And I'm going to illuminate the listeners a little bit more, because there's a process we go through to do this show where I email my guest and say, send me your choices back. And the first choices they send back are often quite weird and wonderful. And I say, have you got anything that, you know, more people might know? That's just a little bit of radio magic wiped away for you. But one of the choices you sent back the second time was a song called Every Day by a band that you had called, and I don't want to embarrass you, Sald. S-A-L-D-E.
Oh,
yeah, and I thought, oh my God, he's chosen some South American, you know, bongo drumming band. It's going to be rubbish. I'm going to have to go back. And then I did a bit of research and I realised that you were talking about Slade.
That's my banana fingers on. That's my banana fingers on the old keyboard.
No, of course, no. It's a standard typo, and so no disrespect intended to point it out. It's just it was this wonderful journey I went on when I thought, oh God, yeah, I'm going to have to tell him again. He can't have that. And it turns out to be Slade, but I didn't know it. Why have I never heard this track before? Because it's great.
I don't know. It's a track that stuck with me. They came out as a single, and it didn't really do anything. It's a very un-Slade-like track, yeah. I think. And or the Slade that we know. I mean, the whole thing about Slade was they were a massive band, big touring band before they sort of became that sort of Christmas number one that we know and love. Mm. And they came from a rock blues place, and this is very much that. And his voice, Noddy's voice on this, is just wonderful. Mm. So. It was a single that didn't, I don't think it did massively well, but...
I think it got to number two in 1974, so it wasn't a bad hit. It's just, I think Slade were just overshadowed by the monster that became glam rock and the cat suits and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and I think, but this is really shows them in all their great sort of blues and rock finery, I think.
Absolutely right. It is the fourth choice of David Morrissey on today's Take 5 on City Talk 105.9. If you have a loved one near them, you may wish to grab them and swing to this. I know me and David are going to do this while we play it.
No,
City Talk 105.9. It is Slade, S-L-A-D-E, and Every Day. City Talk 105.9, that is Slade and Every Day. Thank you, David Morrissey, for bringing that into my life.
It's great, isn't it?
I hope you have that turned up loud at home and I can... inform you that David was air guitaring to that one as well.
Air bassing, I was.
It was bass, yeah. There was a bit of a Mark King slapping.
There was a little bit, which I don't think Slade did, but...
No, didn't have the slap bass, like an episode of Seinfeld around here. We didn't sway, though, unfortunately. David, you're on tonight at Fax. If anyone wants to go and see you, I'm sure there are tickets available. Go to Fax website or Clapperboard UK. You can see David's the film he directed, Don't Worry About Me, and you get to ask him questions afterwards, because there will be a Q&A. We're running out of time fast approaching, but you get to save one object from the house fire as well, David.
Yeah, I've got this very geeky thing in my house, which is an old printer's drawer, which has lots of different compartments in it, and it's on my wall. And I just, wherever I go, I just take little things, you know, from around the world or travels or jobs or wherever I go, and I sort of build up like a life box, really. And I've got two of them, actually. So it's like, you know, just things from my life. I've got tickets for the European Cup final and stuff like that in there, and sort of little photographs and little things that I've got from everywhere I've been, really. And it's just, it's a very geeky little sort of artifacts box. But everything's got a memory for me. And sometimes when the kids are a little bit bored, they come into my office and say, what does this mean? And they test me, and everything's got a little story behind it.
So that's fantastic.
It's
a wonderful thing to save. Were you at Anfield last night, by the way?
I was, yeah.
Are you going to keep the stump for that one?
Oh, God. That was never a penalty, but I was so glad for it. But it happened right in front of me as well, so because I was in the paddock, so yeah. But anyway.
I was in the lower centenary at the other end of the pitch, and we did see he went awful high for that. That didn't look like a normal trip to
it
me.
It was. You wanted to hold up cars, say 3.9 or something, you know what I mean? But it was. But anyway, we deserved at least a point, he says. But no, it was tough.
I think you did. You got one more song to pull out of the metaphorical flames, David Morrissey. Which one have you gone for?
Well, I've gone for the Lars, There She Goes. I know this is a popular track, but it never ceases to move me, really. I love this band. I love this LP. And, you know, they sadly didn't go on to make any more of these great, great tracks, really. Every track on this album is great for me, and I love it. And Lee Mavers is brilliant. So, this is his, yeah.
David, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on to Take 5 today. Can you promise me there won't be any other revelations at the Q&A tonight that I'll read about in tomorrow's Echo?
Yes, my sex change operation I'll bring onto the show next time.
I look forward to reading. We can talk about it next time. Hopefully you come in and see us. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
1, 2, 3, 4. Take 5 with Will Batchelor. City Talk 105.9.